You're listening to the Denver Real Estate Investing Podcast, where it's all about helping you grow your Denver real estate portfolio. Here's your host, Chris Lopez.
Hey, welcome back, everyone, to another episode. And today is going to be a segment in our investing strategy series. So I started the series a few months ago because I wanted to learn other investors' strategies because it's a great way for me and the listeners out there to either create your own strategy or help fine tune it. So in addition to listening and reading today's strategy and other strategies that we have on the website, I highly, and I mean highly recommend that you take the time to write down your own investing plan and goals, as it'll bring clarity and I also think a higher chance of you achieving your goals. I know from personal experience that in the past when I've written down goals, I've been a lot more likely to achieve what I've written down versus the loosey-goosey goals I've just had in my mind that I think about. And since my long-term goal for retirement is to ultimately build a portfolio that produces $20,000 a month in rental income, I am constantly fine-tuning my own strategy and reviewing it and reading it on an almost daily basis. So if you ever want help on your strategy, talk real estate, whatever, I love talking about this stuff. Feel free to reach out to me. And if you want to read other investing strategies, go to denverinvestmentrealestate.com, click on education at the top, and then drop down to investing strategy series, and you'll see our growing list right there. And if you're listening to the podcast, I'll also put a link in the show notes. So today, I have the pleasure of interviewing Mark Cunningham to dive into his strategy. So a little bit about Mark. He is an investor around Denver, but he's also the president at Grace Property Management and Real Estate. Now, something that's really interesting about Mark's background is that he's actually a second-generation property manager. So I believe his dad started the business in 1978. So his business is going on 40 years now of property management in Denver. So he grew up in the property management world. He grew up working with investors, and he's going to have a very, I think, very interesting long-term perspective on real estate investing, because I love hearing about all the stories out there of people investing and making money, but I really love hearing about people that can do it for decades and decades and build a long-term portfolio for that long-term wealth creation. So Mark, thank you for joining us today.
Absolutely, Chris. Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be able to talk with you and impressed with what you have done thus far.
Great. So just to give everyone out there the format of the show, Mark wrote a great, just concisely written investing strategy. It's probably about a half a page, three quarters of a page long. So I'm going to kind of read each section, which is just a few sentences long, and then dive into a bunch of questions with Mark here. So the first section of Mark's strategy is his goal: to acquire debt-free income producing real estate to generate $5,000 per month in cash flow. So to set the stage, Mark, just when did you start investing?
So as you said, my I kind of have a unique background because my dad started a property management real estate company in as you said, 1978. So this is our 40th year this year. So big deal for us. We're turning 40. So we've had kind of the unique perspective. Personally, I kind of grew up in that world, grew up in the real estate investing property management world, got to see a lot of do's and don'ts and learn a lot of things from trying them out. And even better than that, watching other people try them out. So as a property management company, we work with small investors, big investors. We'll help them find a property, acquire it, and then we play the role of landlord. So we're leasing it and managing it for them. So the nice thing about that is we've worked with literally thousands and thousands of investors, and we kind of got to see what worked on their side. And we saw some that were ultra successful. We've seen a lot of crash and burns. So we have gotten to talk to so many individuals to see how they have invested and really watch the results of their investing. And so that's something that is just invaluable to me, so that I could see what other people have done and basically copy them, find the ones that are smart, that work well, adopt those strategies, see the ones that have not done so well, and make sure I stay away from those types of things.
Oh, this is going to be a good interview, Mark. It got me more excited. So let me start off with this. Why 5,000? Why that number?
I set that number quite some time ago, and I'm there now at this point. But I wanted to set something achievable. You know, I didn't want to do this pie in the sky when I first started investing. I didn't want to do this pie in the sky. Hey, I want to go make, you know, $200,000 a year in real estate investing. And I hope to do that. But I wanted something that I could hit in not too long of a period of time. You started off a little bit earlier, asked me kind of, you know, my first investment property. The first property I bought, as so many folks do, was mine. I bought a property for me a number of years ago. I'm from the Denver area here, but I moved out to Arizona for a period of time. And at that point in time, this is going back a little bit, there were what some folks will remember, non-qualifying assumable loans. Now, those have kind of dried up now, but it was a deal where you could walk into a title company with a buyer and seller, sign a couple forms, the buyer could hand the seller some money, and that loan was assigned to the buyer. No qualifications, no income, no credit check, nothing, simply a signature. And so I found a property listed in the classified section of the newspaper and bought that property. I had no job at the time. I had no income at the time, but I wanted to buy something. And so I jumped in and I signed a couple paperwork, signed a couple papers, and suddenly I was the owner of a little condo with a $500 mortgage a month that I had just assigned over to myself. So that was my first step into the real estate investing world. I lived there for a while, moved out of it, held on to it as a rental for a number of years, eventually sold it, and moved that money into something else. So the first several investment properties I acquired were just through that idea of buying myself a condo, living in it for a while, moving out, and holding on to that rental.
So you bought that property and other properties with the end goal of turning into a rental?
I don't even know if I was thinking that far ahead at that point in time. I wanted ideally to do that, yes, but it wasn't some grand plan. It was a idea of just, I hated paying rent. I didn't want to pay someone rent to somebody. I'd much rather own something and live in it. And then when I would move out, sometimes I would sell them, but sometimes I would keep them. So it wasn't so laid out that it was, you know, like an every year type of a thing. It was just kind of as the opportunity presented itself.
Okay. And I mean, as you move forward, I mean, do you have like an end goal in mind to where you hit the goal and you say, okay, that's it, I'm done, I'm retiring to a beach? Or kind of like, what's the end game with your real estate investing?
Yeah, good question. So, you know, I got real much more serious about this in the last several years. So I acquired a few properties and they're just kind of tagging along. And I thought, you know what, I'm getting a little bit older here, so I better start getting a little bit more serious about this stuff. So, today I've got about 8 properties today. So not, you know, I'm not a huge investor from that standpoint. But my end goal, so to speak, that way at this point in time, and I probably need to update this as far as the cash flow standpoint, would probably be to get closer to that $10,000 a month in income and to have these properties debt free. Because I think that's, for me and for working with so many investors I've seen, you know, that debt-free aspect is something that's often overlooked. Cash flow is great, but living in the property management world, problems happen. And if you can eliminate the debt, eliminate the biggest expense most people have, which is your mortgage, that just drastically changes the entire scope of your portfolio, reduces the risk, and it helps you sleep better at night.
So, I mean, how do you balance the, you know, paying things down versus leveraging up to increase your rate of acquisitions? What's your take on that?
So I think for a new person starting off, you know, as they come in and they buy that first property, and you know, 99% of the people probably are going to have a loan on that, and that's fine. You know, what we advise folks to do, and this is what, you know, I kind of wish I would have done a little more of, is, you know, buy that property and then throw everything you can at that property, at least until you get it down to a 75% loan to value. Get some equity built in there, number one. And number two, get some savings on the side. You know, I talk to a lot of people and they say, well, gosh, I'm gonna buy this property and it will cash flow for me and I'm gonna make $50 a month if everything goes fine. Well, that's just not gonna happen. I mean, you know, to quote the great philosopher Mike Tyson, you know, everybody has a plan until they get punched in the face. And if you're in the real estate investing world, you're going to get punched in the face. A tenant's not going to pay rent. A hot water heater is going to blow up. You know, something's going to happen. So if you're banking on this whole deal working for $50 a month, I know how it's going to work for you. I know exactly what's going to happen. You're going to lose this property, or you're going to come close to it from getting into a negative cash flow. So you've got to get to where you've got some significant equity in the property, number one, and that you've got some significant cash sitting on the sideline to step into the property when something bad happens. So, you know, that means the process for most investors is a little bit slower if you do it that way, but the safety is great from that aspect. As I said, we've worked with thousands and thousands of investors, and there's one and only one commonality point of failure in all the investors we've seen fail. We've worked with some smart investors who have succeeded. We've worked with some dumb investors who've succeeded. We've worked with hardworking investors, lazy investors, and all of those will succeed potentially. But the one point of commonality in failure for every single failure we've seen is over leverage, because you can survive almost any mistake if you've got manageable debt. But if you've got a mortgage that is just, you know, sucking every penny out of your property, and then when something goes wrong, and it will eventually, that can just be the nail in the coffin for so many folks. So, I'm not some crazy anti-debt guy. I get that. I've got a finance degree. I understand that. I understand leverage. But the risk that comes with it and the failure that can incur if people over leverage, I think is something that enough people don't pay attention to.
So I got two questions I want to dive down into on what you said there. So the first one is, as people aggressively pay down to that 70, to only have like a 75% loan to value ratio. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know this, if I prepay $20,000 of my mortgage to get that value down there, but a year later I stop making payments, the bank doesn't care that I prepaid that. So do you generally recommend people like refinance there to lower the monthly payment, take out equity, or what happened? Like if I'm your client, I hit that 75% ratio, what do I do next? What's my next step?
So I think it's a little bit specific to the individuals, what they want to do. But what I typically would recommend, get it to 75, and then at that point, then now start saving up for your down payment on your next property. So now just make your regular mortgage payment. Now you're not going to throw everything at this single property. Now you can go acquire property number two. But to have 25% equity in a property is going to, it's going to give you a cushion if something blows up. If the market crashes, it's not going to drop 25%. If someone's personal financial world collapses and they've got to go sell that property, they're going to be able to get some equity out. It gives you a cushion. It gives you some play so that if you need to tap that equity, now there is something there to tap.
Gotcha. So the second question, you mentioned cash reserves. I know it's all personal, but what's your, I'll say, rules of thumb or general advice for how much cash reserve? 6 months of expenses, a year's worth of expenses, a flat 10K? What's your advice?
So our advice to investors is to have 3 months worth of rent at a minimum as a cash reserve. So if your property's renting for $1,000 a month, you should have $3,000 sitting in your savings. Now that's not enough to cover the worst case scenarios, but it's going to give you something. So I think that would be a great starting point for that first property that's running for $1,000 a month. Have $3,000 you can tap into.
So I want to jump to your next section of your investing plan and continue with some questions. So the next section of Mark's investing plan is titled Acquisition Plan: Acquire Property Through the MLS, Through Opportunities to Purchase from Clients, Through door flyers placed in neighborhoods of interest, and any other means. So, I mean, now the current properties you have, I think you said you have 8 now. What's the general mix of where those deals came from?
Several of them were properties that I had lived in at one point in time and then just moved out of. So I've got a couple single families. I've got a couple townhomes. The majority of them I've just acquired either through MLS regular sales, or because we're in the real estate property management world, we'll have clients that at points in time want to sell. And so that can be a great source for us. Client wants to sell. Well, you know, there's no better buyer than us. We know the property. We know the client. Oftentimes they're already occupied with the tenant. That lets us just step in and acquire from there. Now, currently where I'm at right now is I've shifted my philosophy a little bit on the quality of the property. I want higher quality properties. And so I've been buying a couple newer properties, and I'm not getting the deals from the financial side on those things. But from a long-term perspective, that's what I want. I want the Class A high quality properties, which is harder to get in a bargain. It's harder to find those things on a deal. But I think that's from, again, the long-term perspective, I'm okay with that. I've kind of gone from that philosophy starting off with where I would want good properties at great prices. And you know, that's what I always want. I want a good property at a great price. Well, I've shifted that a little bit now. So today I want great properties and I'm okay with a good price, because I think long-term, the great properties are the ones that are going to appreciate the best. They're the ones that are going to be the easiest to manage, going to have less problems with those. And I'm probably not going to get a great price on that, but that's okay. But I want a good price on those properties. But I think going back to, again, what I started off with, seeing what the clients I've worked with, seeing those that have been so successful, that's been the philosophy that has worked for so many people, is get the best property you can afford.
So can you give us like a local example? Because, you know, great property, Class A, it's all very subjective to everyone's personal point of view. Can you give us a few like detailed examples of what you mean? Like, is it location? Is it property type? Is it less than 15 years old? Can you drill down on that?
Yeah, I'll give you just kind of a personal example. So I've got a property right now. It's I wouldn't call it a C-class, but it's probably a B-class property. Just a little condo in Thornton. It was built in the early 80s. One bedroom condo, you know, 900 square feet, and it's fine. It's just fine. It turns over somewhat regularly. It's a little bit older. I replaced the HVAC unit this last year in there, as well as the hot water heater. So it's older. I'm pumping money into it, and it's a little bit of a hassle to manage. Now I bought it for a great price. It's a fine property that way. Now you compare that to the last property I bought, which is in the Loveland, Colorado area, and I bought a single family home, new construction, high end neighborhood. It's kind of one of those wee cottages. You know, it's not like those mini homes that are like 500 square feet, but it's this new concept of a wee cottage. So it's like,
I've never heard that term before.
So it's a single, technically, on paper, it's a townhome, but it's a freestanding townhome. So it's a two-story freestanding townhome, one-car garage, two-bedroom, two-bath, 1,000 square foot.
And how do you spell that? You said a wee cottage?
Yeah, cottage. I mean, that's what that's kind of the terminology they use for these things. So, you know, did I get a deal on that thing? No way. I paid $270,000. I mean, a lot of money for a wee cottage, right? But it's in an amazing part of town. It's got fabulous amenities. It's all new construction in the area. It's kind of close to where I live. And that's a big thing for me as well now, because I want properties that are closer to me. I don't want to have to, I live in the Loveland area. So I don't want to have to drive to South Denver to go do a maintenance issue on my property. I really like the idea of stuff being close. And again, I've been doing this for a while, so I'm kind of at the later stages, but there is some of that kind of pride of ownership, right? I mean, I want something that I can have some pride in. I can say, gosh, that's a property I own, and it's Class A, and it's great amenities, and it's close. And I like that aspect. Now, as my cash flow is much, much lower on this property. I don't think I'm cash flowing hardly anything at all. But from the longer term perspective, again, once I get this thing paid off, which will take a little while, but once I get this paid off, this is going to be a long term hold. I'm going to have, I've had zero maintenance because it's new, but maintenance is, again, and I'm kind of turning a corner here. I think maintenance is something on those older properties that people overlook. When they're doing their cash analysis on older properties, they have problems, and you end up dumping more money than you typically think into those types of properties. We had a Go ahead. Do you have a break-in question there, Chris?
I think you're about to lead there. I'm curious. Let's jump into some property valuation, some rules of thumbs, because, I mean, you're in an interesting point of view where you know what happens when people buy properties 1, 2, 5, 10 years later. What, I mean, do you have like a table or matrix you use for if a property is, you know, 1 to 10 years old, estimate 5% of rent, if it's 10 to 30, 10%? Like, how do you kind of plug in some basic numbers as you evaluate properties?
So for my budgeting, I always use 1 month of rent for annual maintenance expenses. So if you're looking for a rough budget number, start there. So if your property is running for $1,000 a month, you're probably going to spend $1,000 a year on maintenance.
But regardless of the age of the property?
Well, no. I mean, that's step one as the rule of thumb.
Okay.
Now from there, though, you're going to edit that number based upon the age of the property. So if your property is newer, you know, this property is brand new, I shouldn't spend anything. It's under warranty, right? So I shouldn't spend anything on this. I'm still going to budget that into my numbers because I want to always budget worst case scenario. So on this property, you know, I've got this thing rented for like $1,500 a month. I'm budgeting I'm spending $1,500 a month on maintenance. Now on my lower income properties or my lower class properties, I'm going to budget a little bit higher. Not a whole lot more because these are condos, and so you don't have the exterior roof, siding, you know, those things are covered by HOAs. So I'm not going to have the major issues on the exterior, but I am going to have the furnace at some point, and I'm going to have the hot water heater, and I'm going to have the carpet and have the paint. So I would, if people are looking to, you know, to budget a number on those older properties, I hate to say 2 times the amount of the monthly rent, but that's probably accurate on those. And what people have to remember is when they're looking at strictly budget numbers and they're going to buy a Class C property and they think it's going to be great, or they're going to buy a fourplex, you know, a fourplex, if they're all 2-bedroom units, that's 8 toilets, right? And so the cost of replacing a toilet, whether the rent is $200 a month or $500 a month or $2,000 a month, you're paying the same dollar amount to replace that toilet.
Mm-hmm.
So, mm-hmm. So if you've got a low income property and you think that the numbers work, better for you, the cap rate is higher, it's a low income property, they don't budget in those high expense numbers that end up coming back and so often biting them. We had a client contact us recently. He said, hey, I just bought a fourplex. I'm so excited about this property. The numbers are awesome. And it was right next door to a fourplex that we managed. So we knew the building. We knew exactly what it was like. And he said, I was looking at this, or I was looking at a couple single family homes, but I landed on this one. I know the numbers are going to work. And he was just excited. So we had a conversation. I didn't want to burst his bubble, but I said, well, before you buy something else next time, make sure you talk to us. And he said, well, why? I said, well, we probably would have steered you into something a little different. He said, but I don't understand. These numbers are great. I said, I know that. I know the numbers. You know, pro forma numbers are only as good as the person giving them to you. All right. So what you're not anticipating, Mr. Buyer, is the fact that this building was built in the 60s and there's not a lot of renovation. And in this case, he did have 8 toilets. And one of those toilets is going to go out this year. I just know it will. There's 8 of them. Right. And it's got the baseboard electric heat and they're kind of falling apart. So you've got to budget higher numbers on the expense side, or the way you offset it, as I said, I try to do is upgrade the property, go to that higher quality property that's not going to have the maintenance side of things, because we're also seeing maintenance costs increase. You know, the cost of a hot water heater today is probably 25% higher than it was 2 years ago, because, you know, Denver has these new rules and regs on hot water heaters and what they have to have installed. So you can anticipate maintenance costs to continue to increase at a higher than inflation rate as well, I believe.
So, I mean, do you, in your calculations, do you use like a 3% expense increase, a 5%, or do you even get that detailed?
I don't get that detailed.
Okay.
I do use a spreadsheet. You know, I love, you said at the beginning of your show, you know, you look at your investment plan almost on a daily basis. And I would encourage people to have that investment plan, but I would also encourage people to have, you know, kind of that cash flow analysis that they're running every single month on their property. So I've got this on mine. It's just a basic Excel spreadsheet, but I'm putting in my rent per month. I'm budgeting out my expenses, you know, my maintenance and repair. I'm budgeting 1 month, as I said, 1 month of income towards expenses. I'm putting in a vacancy factor. which I anticipate to be one half of 1 month's rent per year. Now, in the Denver market, we probably aren't going to experience that right now, but I'm going to budget that in. You know, I'm going to put in my insurance, my taxes, my HOA. I'm going to put in my mortgage payment. But then I'm also going to track every single month on this spreadsheet, when I make my mortgage payment, how much did my principal drop down? And I think that's a great way to kind of self-motivate yourself, is to know how much your mortgage payments drop in each month and how much you're paying in interest. Because if you're fresh on a loan, if you step into a 30-year loan, you know, your principal may be $100 a month. You know, it's not much that you're paying down. So the way I try to think about that, Chris, is I'm paying $100 this month on my principal. If I can somehow scrape together another $100 from not ordering pizza a couple times this month, or however I can come up with it, and I can throw that $100 at the mortgage, what I've just done is kind of leapfrogged over the next month's mortgage payment. I've prepaid an entire month of mortgage by paying $100 now. And you know, that's kind of that financial, that's true from a financial standpoint. You're kind of tricking yourself because you're able to leapfrog over the payment by prepaying the principal. Now you can't really skip over the payment. You're still gonna have to make next month's payment. But what you did skip over is you cut the last month's of payment, the very last month, you cut that off the mortgage. And so when you start looking at it through that lens of, I could prepay an entire month of mortgage payment if I can somehow scrape together $100, that's motivating to me.
Yeah, I understand that. I remember, years ago when I was in finance classes, I started playing around with amortization tables. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing. If you guys have never done it out there, spend an hour or two on Saturday and plug in numbers and play around with what happens when you put an extra, rounded up your payment from $50 a month to $100 a month. I'm sorry, to the next $100. Throwing $100 a month, $200 a month. And it's amazing. A little bit now can shave off a couple years at the end of the mortgage. It's really, really amazing as you dive into the numbers.
So absolutely. No, it sure is. I mean, I've got my amortization table printed in my top right-hand drawer, right here in my home office at home where I'm sitting now. And so every month when I make my mortgage payment, I pull that amortization table out, just printed, and I line through it, I cross through it, and I circle how much principal I paid that month. I circle my balance because I want to keep that at the forefront of my mind to know where my equity is at on that property. And that in and of itself, and I guess I'm kind of a numbers geek on that stuff, but that has done a lot to keep me motivated to try to get the property paid off more. Because once I get a property paid off, that's where the cash flow really starts accumulating. And then what I've done is I'll take my positive cash flow and now I'll start throwing it at another property. So it's a snowball effect. You know, the first one's slow, it takes a long time. But once you get that first one paid off, if you can then take that income from that property and throw it at your next one and get that one paid off faster. And it does take a couple of years on the front end, but boy, once you get a couple of these going, it is amazing between that amortization, as you just talked about, how that just snowballs on itself.
I love that idea of actually like crossing it off every month. Cause I get probably an unhealthy amount of pleasure from crossing things off my to-do list. So I can only imagine how much pleasure I'll get when I cross off numbers from that amortization. I like that idea, Mark.
And here's what, so every January, this will just, you'll think I'm even more of a geek now, but so I run the schedule. I've got a 30-year mortgage, for example, on a property. And I figured out that if I spend a couple thousand bucks a year, I can cut it from a 30-year mortgage down to a 20. I can cut 10 years off my mortgage if every year I can throw an extra couple thousand. So in January, I did this last week, I sent the bank a check for a couple thousand bucks to prepay some interest. Pulled out my amortization schedule and I like crossed off, 6 months worth of payments. I was able to leapfrog over 6 months worth of payments and turn the page. I literally turned the page on the amortization schedule to the next page. Now that's exciting.
I really like that idea. So something I've got so many questions to ask you now from where we're talking. So a quick one before I move on to some bigger questions. You went through a few minutes ago your items you put out in your cash flow statement. I've seen a lot of strategies out there on the internet that talk about you have your maintenance expense and they have a longer term capital expenditure or CapEx expense for things like roofs, water heaters, things like that. Do you break out those items separately, or do you just kind of do the 1 month or 2 months worth of rent for expenses?
I do not break out those items. So I just throw 1 month worth of expenses in, and I know over time, especially on this new one. So I told you I bought a new property, right? And I'm budgeting 1 month of rent for maintenance expenses. Now in year one, I'm not going to have any maintenance expenses. The thing's brand new, but I know at some point I am going to have those capital expenditures. So as a quick, easy way, I just budget 1 month's rent. And I know that some years I'm not going to have a penny of expense. Other years I'm going to have significant stuff. So, and I just like to keep it simple. So I don't want to overanalyze this stuff. So I just budget the 1 month, and I know over the course of years, that's going to be fairly accurate. You know, and this again goes back to the fact that we've done this so many years for so many people. Over time, over a 10-year period for the average property, you're going to spend on average for maintenance what came out to 1 month of rent per year. In some years it may be higher, some years it may be lower, but if you're trying to average this thing over time, that is just a great, easy, quick rule of thumb.
So say that again. You said, so at the 10-year mark, you'll have averaged out 1 month's worth of rent per year over this 10 years?
Yeah. So if a property's renting for $1,000 a month, so that would be $12,000 a year, right? Over the course of 10 years, you're probably going to spend 12 grand on expenses.
Okay.
Which is 1 month rent per year, or 1 year over 10 years. So if you're trying to just, you know, do a quick and easy budget, that's a great number to plug in.
So let me get very detailed with you here. So like on this new construction property you bought, you know, I think you said the $1,500 a month you have budgeted for maintenance this year is really going to be zero. Do you take that $1,500 and put it in a savings account for your future, or do you throw it at the principal to pay down the loan faster?
Great question. What I do is so I've got my portfolio. And so all my portfolio properties, you know, they're cash flowing. I'm taking all my excess cash and I'm dumping it back into my mortgage prepayment. Now, but the reason I'm doing that is because I've got some money sitting on the side for these big time budget expenses should they arise. Now, if I didn't have, you know, and I've got, you know, a fair amount sitting there. So if I didn't have a bunch of money sitting on the side, if somebody didn't have that, then I think it would be wise to build that reserve up, that significant reserve up first. But I've also got a job. I mean, you know, I make money on my job every day. So that job I have on the property management company, you know, that's going to provide me the income I need so that I don't need the income on these properties right now. My whole purpose is to throw everything I can into my portfolio of properties to get them paid off, so that eventually when I don't have my job, my JOB anymore, I quit that, then I can rely on my portfolio. But I think of my portfolio in the same way you should think of like a 401k, right? A 401k, if you're in your working years, it doesn't give you any income right now. It's a retirement plan. Well, this is my retirement plan. So I'm not cash flow. I'm not actually taking money out of this stuff right now. I'm putting money into it. Just like if I had a 401k, I'm 44 years old. If I had a 401k, I'm not pulling money out of it. I'm throwing everything I can into it. So I'm throwing everything I can into my rental portfolio right now so that when I need it in a number of years, it'll be a bigger number for me.
Okay. Another just very detailed question for you. Now, for each property you have, are you one of those people, do you open up like an individual checking account for every property, or do you have one general checking account to kind of manage all the portfolio?
Good question. I've got one general checking account for all my properties.
Okay.
I've got the majority of my properties in one LLC name. You know, I think that's important to get that LLC set up. If people have, you know, if people have one rental property and they're only going to have it for a year or two, then they're going to sell it. You know, we typically don't recommend even going through the hassle of setting up an LLC for ownership. But if it's a long-term buy and hold, or if it's flip, I would definitely run that through an LLC and potentially, you know, put a couple properties in there. We don't recommend people get different LLCs for every property. What we recommend is you get up to about $5 million worth of property in one LLC before you go start another one.
So is that more for liability protection?
Yeah. For liability protection. But the reason I think it doesn't make sense to necessarily have, you know, 10 LLCs for 10 properties is it becomes expensive on the tax side of things. Number one, you've got to file separate reports on those. You've got to maintain the LLCs. And there really is not a need for that. If you've got proper insurance in place and you've got a liability policy, I think you're safe capping that at about $5 million in each LLC.
I'm curious. I mean, how did you come up with $5 million? Did you run an analysis on there? Is it kind of just a round number you picked?
Well, because you can get a liability policy through most insurance companies for about $5 million.
Are you talking like an umbrella type policy?
Uh-huh. Yep, exactly.
Okay, so you buy like a LLC or business-based umbrella policy for that entity.
Yeah, so if you get for most insurance companies, if you just go in and ask them for an umbrella policy, they will extend the umbrella coverage into anything you have an equity ownership in. So for example, I have an umbrella policy on myself, on me, on Mark Cunningham. Well, that policy automatically extends coverage to my LLC.
Oh, okay. That was gonna be my next question. So your personal policy really covers everything then?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So you may not know this, and I know you're not a lawyer, so we'll get that disclaimer out of the way. But I mean, if you have that umbrella policy, would it make that much of a difference if the property's in the LLC or not because you have that same umbrella policy? Because either way, won't the insurance pick up any issues?
Well, I think yes. However, the thing that we don't always think through is the fact that the LLCs will protect the properties from me a little bit as well, right? I mean, let's say I get sued personally for something I did outside the real estate business. Let's say I get in a car accident and, you know, something terrible happens and I get sued and I'm liable. I want to keep my properties completely separate from what somebody can come after me for.
You know, that's interesting. I always took the other route where I, this is me thinking right now, my current state, I don't really need entities for my rental properties because I've got lots of insurance. I got a high umbrella policy, so I'm not worried about something happening to the property. Never thought about that other scenario. So that is, you give me some food for thought on that.
Yeah, well, it cuts both ways, right?
Yeah.
Protect the properties and protect yourself. So I think people can overthink the liability side of things. So you don't want to go too deep on that, but have a strong insurance policy in place, get a separate LLC, if you've got a number of properties, but people don't need to worry, I think, too much about that. In our 40 years, we've never seen someone lose their property ever because of a lawsuit, if they have proper insurance in place. So that the odds of that happening is extremely slim, but still have that strong insurance in place.
Great to know. So something I wrote down about 10 minutes ago, I've been meaning to ask you, I see a recurring theme as you talk about your personal investments, your advice, and just your overall thing. You are definitely playing the long game when it comes to investing, which, you know, in my 20s, I'm 35 now, my 20s, I certainly did not. That's why I was wasting time doing day trading of stocks and currencies and stuff. But a couple of years ago, I got really focused on the long game because I do that in my business. And I realized, hey, real estate and investments and compounding interest, the longer you play, the more likely you are to win. Speak on that for a minute, because I know I talk to a lot of people that come to the website. And, you know, just as look like social media, it's so easy to see everyone living these awesome lifestyles on Instagram and Facebook. People often get caught up in reading these headlines or emails or podcasts about someone that was, you know, unemployed 3 years ago and now has 400 units or, you know, 300 doors somewhere. And now they're making $300,000, $500,000 a year.
Yeah.
In your experience, you know, in wearing your property management hat, what percentage of people do you see have success playing the long game versus that, like, I'll say, quote unquote, overnight success, where it's like, you know, within the overnight being a couple years where they go from like, you know, zero to hero type thing.
Yeah, great question, Chris. And I think for the individual starting off, you do have to kind of play the short game, right? Because you've got to create the income, you've got to create the money that you're going to use to potentially buy a long-term property. You know, so when I first started doing some of this stuff, I mean, I did flips. We've done a lot of those flip deals. But what we would do then, so we do a flip deal, but then take that money from the flip, and the terminology we use is to bank it. Right? How am I going to bank this money? How am I going to protect this money I just made so I don't lose it on another deal? Well, the best way to bank it is to put it now into a long-term buy and hold. So we'll do flips. We do flips, and we'll take the money from that flip, and I'm going to bank it. I'm going to throw it in a mortgage. I'm going to pay something down because now I've protected that money from myself, so I can't go blow it in some other way. I'm not necessarily going to dump it into my next flip. So I'm all for the short game, but you've got to do both. You've got to use your proceeds and your profits from the short game to dump it into the long term. Because if you're only doing the short game, you're doing flip after flip after flip, well, then guess what? Your income is only as good as your next flip. And I don't want that. I don't want to have to go do another flip to eat this month. So take the money from your flip and dump it into your long-term investment portfolio. And that, I think, is what has worked so well for many, many people.
And speak on that for a minute, because I talked to, about 2 years ago, I was very interested in kind of using the flipping model to generate a bunch of cash to be able to go out there and buy more long-term properties. And I've done one flip, and I mean, we actually made money, it went well, but I'll say reality hit me and I realized that, wow, flipping is not investing. It's a business. It's really a self-employed business. You have a job for a couple months, then you're out of a job, you have a job for a couple months. And I realized, wow, if I want to do this, and I was very confident in my ability to be able to go flip and make money, but I thought, wow, it's going to take me a couple of years to be able to scale it up, to get through that learning curve, to pay my dues, versus let me focus on my other strategies, which is online marketing, to use that to generate money to buy property. I actually stepped away from that initial thought I had to go flipping. So for people out there who are looking to make that initial cash, give them, what it really takes to start a flipping business, how long it takes to make, and like, what's the timeline they're really looking at to actually turn that into something that they can really use to fund their real estate long-term portfolio?
Good question. I think that is so market specific. It's hard to give a hard answer to that. Mm-hmm. If someone is interested in flipping, I think one of the things they may fall into is thinking of it as a flipping business, right? Don't think of it as a flipping business. Think of it as finding an opportunity and capitalizing on that opportunity. And if your goal is to create a flipping business, it's going to be much more difficult than it is to go find your first flip, do it, and then you may not find another one for a long period of time. And hopefully with marketing, you can. But the idea of following the opportunity as it presents itself is paramount. And if the opportunity is to do a flip, then you do the flip. If the opportunity is a great buy and hold that comes across your desk, then go for the buy and hold. But true entrepreneurs are so good at following the opportunity. So I would encourage people not to box themselves in to saying, I'm going to have a flipping business and now I've got to go find my business. No. If you're an entrepreneur, if you're a real estate entrepreneur, you're going to follow that opportunity. And if the opportunity is that flip, great, do the flip. But if you're locking yourselves into only doing flips, you will get burned eventually. I mean, on a flip, you will get burned. So you've got to, and it almost goes back to what we started with this whole conversation with, then you better have some reserves. Because in the same way you're going to get burned on a long-term property management tenant relationship, you'll get burned at some point on that flip. So that's why I personally like the idea of kind of banking that money that you make on your flip. And you guys have talked a lot about flips, and it's great to work with an agent like you guys to help somebody on a flip. But those are tricky. I mean, those are very, very dangerous and tricky to do, especially in the hot market we're in right now, where everything is, if it's not overpriced, it's certainly priced competitively.
So I just want to reiterate what you said there about pursuing the opportunity. That is great advice, and advice that took me years and years of me going through the motions to learn myself. To people out there listening, I would definitely rewind and listen to what Mark said there the last couple of minutes. That is just really great advice and one of my guiding principles now as well. Oh man, I am totally off the my questions here, Mark, with our investing strategy. I'm gonna get us back on track here so we can finish it. All right. And I realize, this is going great, but for people out there listening, if you go to the website, you'll be able to read Mark's plan in its entirety versus it being chopped up. But just these questions are just going great. So I want to jump to the next section here. Before I do that, in your acquisition plan, you said you place door flyers in neighborhoods. Now, I know a lot of people, as they go out there on the internet and talk to people, they're told, hey, go do the grind, go knock on doors, do flyers, make cold calls. I'm curious, do you, door flowers, is that like a monthly consistent thing you're always doing? Or is it just something you do once in a while? Like, just talk to me about what you do with that.
So today, I really don't do that today. We've done it in the past. And I think at the point in time we started doing it, this is a number of years ago, and I got a certified letter in the mail one day, big envelope, certified return receipts, which as a real estate investor always scares you, right?
Uh-oh. I'm like, oh, yeah.
I'm about to get sued. What's this? So I tear it open, and it's a handwritten letter, and it says, I own a condo in this particular condo complex, and I've been doing some research through the assessor's office, and I see that you own several units in this complex. I would like to sell my unit. It's in terrible shape, needs a ton of work. Would you have interest in buying it? And so, you know, my red flag goes up. I'm like, what's going on? This is like, I'm about to get conned here, right?
Yeah.
Something's going on here. And so I call the woman, I go out there, and it's totally legit. This woman lived in this property. It was a dump. She owned it. She had started to rehab it, got stuck in the rehab process, and now she just wanted out and she didn't even know what to do. And I thought, how ridiculous is it that this woman had to go to public records, search for other buyers in the area or other owners in the area. She found me, she sent me a certified letter, all to try to get me to buy her property, which we did. We bought her property, we got a great deal on it. You know, she came out fine, so she was happy. She walked away with some money. We got a good deal on the property, we finished the rehab, and we ended up flipping it. It was a win-win across the board. But that bothered me that I made her go to so much effort to find me. And at that point we thought this is silly. If somebody like her is out there and there are people like her out there, I want her to be able to find me a lot easier than having to go to public records. So at that point, especially as it related to some of these condo complexes, we started just dropping flyers out there, putting a flyer up in the mailbox area or by the pool, or dropping them on the doors. Just walk the complex, spend an hour walking a complex and just drop a little flyer in there saying, hey, I'm interested in buying properties in this complex. If you're ever interested, give me a call and we'll see if we can do a deal. Because if somebody's ready to sell and they think they can, you know, save that real estate commission they would have to pay to use an agent,
yep,
well, we'll do it. I mean, why not split that, you know, split that 5-6% that they would pay an agent anyway, between you and the seller. And we started doing that, and I was pleasantly surprised at the number of deals we would find. And it's not like every day, it's not like our phone started ringing off the hook, but we got some deals done that way where people would, when they're ready to sell, they held on to that little flyer because we were buyers and we would get some good deals. So I think that can be effective for people.
I am flabbergasted that she sent you certified mail to sell her own property. That is like every investor's dream.
I know.
Wow.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
So I'm curious, do you have any, like, my marketing mind is turning now because it's always about numbers. You know, if you put out 1,000 flyers, you get 20 phone calls, 20 phone calls, 10 appointments, 3 good people. Do you have any types of like metrics that you could see for how many flyers you turned out to that what you received? I know there's a ton of variables in there, but just any just numbers you can associate with that?
I really don't. Okay. For us, I mean, we would target the complex, right? I mean, we would find areas or complexes where we'd say, this is a good complex. We feel this complex is undervalued and we want to get one in here. So we would just target that complex. And it's not like we'd be out there every week. We don't want to annoy people, but we'd do it. And then maybe 2 months later, we'd do it again. So we would really target that one. And if we could pick up one deal out of that complex, well, that more than paid for the price of a couple hundred pieces of paper printed, kind of a thing. But no, I don't have a hard, you know, give out 100 and you'll get one call. I think it's so complex specific and individual specific.
Yeah. And did you even get to the, I'm assuming not, but did you get to the point where you would do like different flyers to split test or to spice things up, or you just, hey, methodical, drop the flyers and we'll pick up some deals?
It was just drop the flyers, and it was just kind of a straightforward, hey, I currently own a unit in this complex. I'm interested in buying another one. If you're ever interested in selling, please give me a call. I mean, it was, you know, it wasn't salesy. It wasn't gimmicky. It's just, I'd like to buy a property.
Well, that speaks to taking action beats any perfect plan and trying to come up with a perfect marketing funnel. So that is,
yeah,
I see why it works.
You know, people, the guy that spent the day sitting at his desk designing the flyer, well, I spent the day walking the complex. So, you know, that idea of take massive action. And I think, you know, one of the, you sent me over your kind of list of questions, and then I'm going to jump way ahead of us here.
Yep.
But you know, that's one of the things that I see as the biggest mistakes people do make is they overanalyze these things. They want to run the numbers, and they want to just dissect and learn and go to the conferences. You know, we call them conference junkies, right? I mean, they're the front row at every conference. They never bought a deal, but they're the front row taking notes of every conference. People just got to act. You just got to go out there. And even if that first deal isn't the best deal in the world, you can't learn any better than by doing it, than by taking action and going out there, especially if you're a long-term buyer. If your plan, like mine is a little bit on the long-term, who cares if you overpaid by 5%? If you're going to be holding this thing for 30 years, the 5% that you overpaid is irrelevant. So don't get so caught up in the numbers that it keeps you from taking action.
I'm nodding my head in agreement. So let me jump on to the section of your plan that's titled Debt Plan. And it states, as the goal is to acquire debt-free properties, no more than 50% of properties may have debt against them at any one time. The debt level on any one property may not exceed 75% of the value. Financing should be as short-term as possible with a great aggressive amortization schedules. All profits from properties will be used to pay down loan balances on other properties. Now, we already kind of talked some about this, but why the 50% of only 50% of properties may have debt against them? Why?
Well, starting off with, that was not part of my plan. I mean, couldn't have done that, right? I mean, when you buy your first property, you're going to have debt. So, you know, I built that in the last couple of years because most of my properties don't have debt against them now. So that's kind of my stopgap for me to keep me from going back and borrowing against these properties that I've worked so hard to pay off. So, you know, I, as I said earlier, I want to bank this money. I want this there, safe, and the equity. Now, if, I mean, if an emergency happens, yes, I could go get it. I do have a large home equity line of credit that I could tap on one of my properties. So I keep that accessible at all the time. But I want these things paid off. That's the investor that I want to be. We've got investors we work with. You know, I can think a couple of them in particular. Got one guy in particular, right? And his mom, about 50 years ago, she just bought a bunch of properties. She'd buy a property every year, and then she wanted to pay these things off. So she left them to her son. She has an adult son now. So this adult son now, he's got, I don't know, 25 free and clear properties. And every month, we're writing this guy a check for about 20 grand. Every month, month in, month out, month in, month out. We've been doing this for years for this guy, right? I mean, that's what I want to leave my kids. And not say I want my kids to work hard. I want them to, right? But I want to get to the point where, man, I've got 20 grand flowing in every month, month after month after month. Now, this guy could go out there and he could leverage these properties and he could go buy 100 more. But I've seen that. I've seen the way that plays out. And it may work, but it may not work. So I think, and that's what I love about real estate. I'm not that smart of a guy. But if you just aren't stupid and you go slow and steady, even a guy who's not that smart like I am not can be successful in real estate.
So talking about the was it short term as possible for your financing? Do you always do like 15-year, 30-year, 5-1 ARMs, or is it all just specific to the property and the current state of the market?
It's a little bit specific to the property. So right now, I've got the last property I bought, or a recent one I bought, I did a 10-year fixed rate on it, and I love going with community banks. You know, lending is tough, so I would encourage people to contact a community bank. You know, I use First Bank. They're a local community lender, but because they're community banks, they're not tied to all of the federal banking regulations, and it's not as sticky. So I love the community banks, but we'll go in and you know, I did a 10-year fixed on this deal. Now it's a negative cash flow for me on this particular property. It's costing me money every month, but it goes back to my philosophy of this is my 401k, right? And if I had a 401k, I'm going to put money into that every month. Well, why not put it into my property every month? Because my mortgage is getting paid down. My equity is building up. It's a negative cash flow, but that's okay for my particular philosophy right now. So it's a 10-year mortgage. I'm just over a year in on this deal. So in 9 more years, if I can't pay it off faster, you know, I'll have this property free and clear and paid for. And that's something that's attractive to me. Another property I have on a 30-year mortgage because it's more of that appreciation play. So I may end up selling it in a couple of years if it appreciates the way I think it will. So it is property specific, but from a big term perspective, I'm all for that aggressive amortization.
Okay. And something actually I wanted to ask you a while back when you're talking about, you have a large cash reserve for your rainy day fund. Something that I'm currently debating, and I talked about this when I recorded a podcast about a month or two ago for my own investing plan, is I have I'm a big believer in holding cash reserves because I think, my biggest fear is not being able to ride out a curveball in my life or a curveball in the market. If I can hold on to the property for 30 years, I'll be a happy camper and my kids will be happy campers as well down the road. But my finance side is always like, wow, your money's in the bank. You're losing money to inflation. Versus, hey, you can do a very, conservative investing plan and you're more than likely, statistically speaking, to earn a return and always have whatever amount of money you need on there. Do you have any like a cash reserve investing plan, or how do you store your cash reserve, if you don't mind me asking?
Yes. So my hope is, my plan is to get like 50 grand in an account, right? 50,000 cash.
Yep.
And that's my rainy day fund. That's what I want. I'm not there right now, but that's what I want to have. Now, I've gotten there in the past, and what I find myself doing is I'll take that money and I'll go buy another property, and that becomes my down payment. So I kind of cheat myself a little bit, but I find a good deal and I think, well, gosh, I've got 50 grand sitting right there. I haven't used it in a while, so I'm going to use that for my down payment. Now, it took me a long time to get that 50 grand saved up. It's not there overnight. But then that will deplete it. And then I get scared and I think, oh man, I got to get that reserve built back up. And so I start throwing money back at there. But I think that just kind of, you have to look at your personal financials. How much money do you have coming in your other sources of income? And if there's no other money coming into your sources of income, if this is it, like if you're only real estate, then you better keep that rainy day fund there and liquid. I've got a job, so I've got income coming in other streams. But that idea of having multiple streams of income, your real estate being one of them, your day job being another, that can give you a little bit more leverage, I think, on the money, and you don't have to have as much tied up, as you said, not earning anything for you.
And so I'm assuming, do you just keep that I'll say rainy day fund, opportunity fund, just in a checking account or savings account, something that just you didn't care about the interest on there?
Yeah, I do.
Okay. Yeah, you just keep it there. Yeah, you don't care about it?
I don't care about it. Yeah, okay. I mean, it's not a ton of money, and the interest rates are so goofy right now. And I know I'll probably use it for something at some point anyway. Maybe I'll just throw it at a loan that I have on a property. So I'm not overly concerned about getting a couple bucks in interest on it.
Okay. Let's see here. So as far as something I want to ask you about when you evaluate properties, for a quick rule of thumb as you're doing, I'll say your broad level, 10,000 foot level view of analyzing properties, what's your quick analysis? Is it cash on cash, cap rate, or is it simply just a gross difference between mortgage and rent? What's your quick way to analyze properties?
Yeah, great question. So I mentioned how I kind of have a spreadsheet that I run on all my properties. And so there's a couple formulas I have on there that I kind of use to track. So it's not just one, but I put these things together. And so one of those things is cap rate. I mean, I think that's worth looking at. Now in the single family rental market in Colorado right now, your cap rate's going to stink. It's just hard to find anything with a good cap rate right now, but I want to track that. Another thing I look at is my rent to purchase price, right? The percentage of the rent as compared to the purchase price. And I want to keep that as close to 1% as possible. Meaning the ideal is if I buy a property for $100,000, it should rent for 1% of that. It should rent for $1,000 a month. And for many, many years, that rule worked. It worked in the Denver market for the longest time until prices started popping. So you can't go buy a property for $200,000 right now and rent it for $2,000 a month. That rule of thumb just isn't there. But you still want to get as close as you can to that 1%.
So that 1% rule, you're since the markets, you know, the housing price has gone so much to kind of eclipse that 1% rule, are you sitting on the sidelines and waiting till the market corrects and comes back down? Or are you buying into it? What's the plan going forward?
I'm buying into it simply because I feel pretty confident in the Colorado and the Denver market. I don't, you know, and I could be wrong. I don't think we're going to see a crash like we saw a decade ago in our lifetime. I mean, that was a confluence of the weirdest events you can imagine that all transpired at the exact same moment that led to that. And depending on the market you look at, even that worst case scenario where it seemed that, you know, the world financial markets, I mean, to some extent, literally collapsed, right? Well, if you look at certain markets, I looked at the Fort Collins market. Did you know that in the Fort Collins market, when the housing, the national housing and the state housing market collapsed, average sale prices in the Fort Collins market dropped like 4%. Four. I mean, that's a sidebar. I mean, who cares? 4%. That's as bad as it got there. So I think if you're in a solid market, then you're not going to see those huge price swings or declines. You know, I'm a little bit leery personally right now of the downtown Denver market. I think there's too much overbuilding. I mean, it takes two hands to count the cranes now that you see up there.
Yep.
And there's so much Class A multifamily properties coming online. So I would not be a buyer of condos or townhomes in the Denver market because you're competing on the rental side with these brand new, beautiful, high-end Class A properties that have fitness centers and dog parks and every amenity imaginable. That is hard to compete with. And we're seeing rental rates drop on condos and townhomes in the Denver market right now. So I think the ideal play is the single family homes. If you can get a single family, you have no competition as far as the big money builders. You know, there aren't builders out there buying single family properties they're going to rent out. So there's always going to be less supply of that. Your tenants stay for a much longer basis because tenants in single family homes just aren't as, they don't move as often. They're going to stick around. So I think that's the play. So, and now I don't even remember your original question, Chris. I'm sorry. I've got
off. No, this is great. I got two new questions for you. So my old question doesn't even matter. So you will accept a lower cap rate on a single family detached property now.
Yeah.
Versus doing an attached property because you think that's a better long-term play as far as just rental vacancy long-term appreciation or just kind of everything?
Both, everything. Okay. And so that property class comes into play as well. And this is something that has evolved with me over time because I've been doing this for a while. So you know, the property classes I want now are really A-class properties. I couldn't do that to begin with. I couldn't afford an A-class property. And beginning investors can't. That's fine. You know, get the best property you can afford, though, I think is a good rule of thumb. But I'm going now for those A-class properties because they are easier to manage. They are going to appreciate faster over time as compared to the C-class stuff. You know, C-class stuff doesn't appreciate. It cash flows great oftentimes, but there's very, very little appreciation to that.
And going back to your comments about just all the Class A stuff going up in Denver, I don't know if you even know the numbers on it, but how far of a radius out are you seeing possible the downward pressure on rents from that? Is it just within the downtown area? Like how far out is it expanding?
It is expanding outside of that. I mean, first it was just downtown, but we've seen that expand out to the kind of the Highland area. Mm-hmm. It's definitely expanding over there. You know, these hedge funds, these REITs, REITs, you know, they've got money and they're coming in and they're building multifamily Class A stuff and they've got money to burn. And so they're burning it. I mean, and they're dumping money into these complexes and it is growing outward. So I like the suburb areas of Denver, but I like the single family properties in the suburb of Denver because you can rent those things all day long. And even when the market collapsed, to use that terminology, you know, we saw rental rates drop maybe 10%. So instead of getting $1,000 a month, you're getting $900 a month. You know, so you're going to weather any kind of a bad storm that comes through. But if the market does go through a really big, bad downturn, the first properties to get hit are going to be those Class A properties because there's an overabundance of those and tenants are going to move to save some money, they're going to want to move to Class B properties. And there are no Class B properties, or very few, I should say, very few Class B properties in the multifamily world, which means then that those Class A properties, they drop their rents to keep the people back in, which just puts this increasing downward pressure on the multifamily world. So that condo, townhome, multifamily world, that is where the highest risk is.
Interesting. And so, I mean, I know a lot of, you know, I don't have any experience with Section 8, but I know Charles is a big advocate of Section 8. Do you have any insight into what happened with like Section 8 rentals or the, you know, the rental vouchers when the market downturned? Is it the same downward pressure, similar, or do you know?
They were somewhat immune because of the, I mean, that's the benefit of the Section 8 program. And yeah, we do a fair amount of the Section 8, and there's pluses of that and there's minus of that, but people just have to know the good, the bad, and the ugly with that. Because, you know, for example, on one of the negatives, Section 8 can deny a rent increase. So if you've got a Section 8 tenant and let's say your rent, the market rent goes from $1,000 to $1,100, you can give the tenant a notice of rent increase and Section 8 can potentially say, yeah, we're not going to approve that. We're not going to let you bump the rent up that high. We're going to cap it. I mean, that's rent control. That's exactly what that is. So, you know, there are some risks associated with that. Our philosophy is if you've got a slow rental market and you're having trouble filling your vacancies, then look to the Section 8 program. If the rental market's hot and you have no trouble filling your vacancies, then why let Section 8 come into your property? Because they're going to require you to do things and they're going to be inspecting and they're going to, you know, you're letting the government in your front door, and that's going to cause potentially some issues.
Okay. Going on to another section, your investing strategy, it's labeled ownership structure / partnerships. And you write, no partnership should be created without hard consideration to the individuals, including the spouses and families of the proposed partners. Now that's the end of your writing. And this, I'm very interested in this topic because I've had in other businesses, not real estate related, I've had a great business partnership. That's been incredibly just fulfilling and profitable. And I've had a bad business partnership, which was just, it was rough and, you know, really, really rough when things got worse. It's like getting married, essentially. So I'm really curious, what's your, define a hard consideration for me. Do you have a checklist for this or a spreadsheet? If you do, I want to buy that copy from you.
No, I do not have a spreadsheet or a checklist. Yeah, so great question on the ownership. And you know, I've always lived by that phrase. I've heard it. And I think there's a lot of truth to it. Is the what is the only ship that's guaranteed to sink is a partnership, right? So that idea of partnerships, as you said, when they work, they're beautiful. But when they don't work, they can just sabotage everything. So, you know, and again, I use this from the philosophy of we've worked with so many investors. And I've seen a lot of partnerships that have just destroyed relationships and have destroyed deals. So I have a couple partners on deals. I'm partnering with my dad on a couple deals. I partner with a buddy of mine on a couple deals. But I would be very, very hesitant to take a partner on in anything because you don't know what can happen to that relationship. And unless you know that person and you trust them on a deep, deep level, I would be very, very hesitant. You know, as you said, you're getting married to somebody, and you are. I mean, there's a reason people use the terminology of, you know, a partnership's like getting into bed with somebody. And it is, because you're exposing yourself and you are going to be at their mercy, especially if it's a 50-50 partnership. So, you know, something else to consider on those partnership deals is always have a partnership agreement, always, 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 and outline in that agreement what's going to happen to the partnership if things go south. And I think what do they call it? The four D's, right? Partnership agreement should talk about death, divorce, disability, and drugs, the four D's. And it's, you know, death is obviously pretty straightforward, but think about that for a minute. What happens if a partner dies? If my partner in a deal passes away, unless I have something structured, I am now partners with his or her spouse.
Yeah.
Right. So I've got a buddy of mine and we do partnership deals, but one of the reasons I do it is because I like his wife and we're good friends as well. And I would be comfortable working with her because if something happens to him, she's my new partner. And what if, you know, the other D is divorce. What if your partner gets divorced and you don't have this documented in your partnership agreement? Suddenly you have a judge who could put, who could give their half of the partnership to the leaving spouse. So suddenly you have a new partner. You know, these are the kind of things that people don't play out, because when you're starting a partnership, it's all roses and everything's going to be beautiful. But you've got to take the time to write up that partnership agreement and talk about what's going to happen to the partnership if somebody A wants out, or if one of those other D's happen. So for, you know, for example, my partnership with my buddy, one of the things we have in there is if either partner ever wants out, then the other one either has to buy him out at the current value, or we sell the property.
And do you go as far as like taking out life insurances on each other for like, you know, that worst case scenario? So there's that buyout, or how do you kind of go for that? Even like that, I'll say worst case scenario, because my biggest fear in some of the partnerships I've had was, you know, I'll say my business partner dies. Now I'm business partners with the spouse, and then spouse remarries. Now I'm business partners with this new person over here. And it terrified me. We had life insurances for the part of the buyout agreement. Like, how deep do you go? Is it all just deal specific and partnership specific?
I think it's deal specific and partner specific. And I mean, I'm fine with doing partners on a deal, but I would tie it to that deal. You know, I counsel people not to do the big partnership deals in business, but go on a deal by deal basis. We do not have life insurance tied in to that extent for it. But the deals I have with my partners as well, they're small enough deals that if one of us had to buy the other one out, we could make that work.
Okay. So, but you've got that account for the thing. So you've got that like plan B contingency.
Yeah. And we've also got ours set up as, you know, in Colorado, you can do what is called a limited liability, limited partnership, an LLLP. So our deals are set up that way. And what that means from a legal standpoint is I'm the general partner and he's the limited partner. And that gives me the control. So I'm kind of a control freak. All right. So I don't want a partner who's going to want high degree of control on our rental properties. And we talked about this on the front end, you know, my buddy and I did. And I said, look, if the property turns over, I don't want to call you and ask you what color you want to paint the property. You know, I'm going to do it. And he just kind of, he's a silent partner. He's like, no, that's great. You just, you know, you run the things and I totally trust you. And that's why it works, because we don't converse. I don't have to call him and say, well, gosh, what do you think we should do with the rental rate? You know, do you want to increase it? Do you not? You know, I'm making those calls because I'm the general partner, but we set that up on the front end so that we both understand that.
Yeah, it's very smart. And I'm just kind of really hashing this point because I've talked to a lot of people out there. I'll say a lot of the newer, younger investors, where they're all, many are trying to find partners on like long-term buy and hold deals. And, you know, they're excited, they want to do it. And I'm like, yeah, you've only known the good times. Wait until money gets tough and your business partner, you meet your real business partner when money or the going gets tough, and be prepared for that and have those contingencies in place, because it can have a ripple effect and really screw you over.
I would counsel somebody to, you know, if that means you have to wait a little bit longer and save up a little bit more money yourself, then do it that way. But you don't, you know, if that's the only way you can get in, fine, I guess do it. But I'm so glad I didn't start off with partners on deals. It gives you the degree of freedom that you really want and need, I think, to be successful in real estate.
So I've got a few, I know we're running way over the hour that I planned here, Mark, so I appreciate you taking the time here. I've got a few just kind of general questions here I want to start wrapping things up with. You've mentioned a few times throughout our discussion that referencing multiple streams of income. Obviously, you have your job, you've got your property management business, you've got your rental portfolio. Are you an active investor in the stock market or other investments, or do you focus on your job and real estate?
I've got a little bit of money in the stock market, just some retirement stuff, but I'm not active in there. No, I've had bad luck in the stock market. So every investment I seem to make, every time I play the market, I lose. So I'm going to stick with real estate as far as that goes. But I do have some retirement funds that are tied up in there. And I've still got my job, my business, my property management company. So I've got revenue coming in from that. I do a fair amount of teaching and speaking to real estate groups on property management. So I've got an income stream on that. But philosophically, I'm a big believer in that. And again, that goes back to just seeing what works for others and wanting to copy it. That multiple streams of income, of revenue, is a key cog in the success wheel. You've got to get those income streams coming in different ways, because eventually something may happen to one of those income streams. So I want to get as many income streams as I can.
Eventually, I would say it's when, not if.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, that's I've had my income streams, and yeah, sometimes you're doing great, then a year later I'm like, whoa, what the heck happened to it?
So if you, real estate, you can set it up on the side. You can still work your day job.
Yeah, and that's I wish I got into real estate in my 20s versus wasting time trying to do active trading, the stock market and currency tradings. But oh well, live and you learn. And I honestly think that anyone out there listening, stock market's great, but go passive. If you want to try to play the market, play real estate. You can get so much more from taking massive action, like Mark was saying, through door flyers and networking, doing stuff like that. Be an active investor in real estate. Be a passive investor in the stock market is one of my big, big beliefs now after 15 years of dipping my toes in various games so far.
I would agree.
So if you could go back in time and talk to your younger self from an investing standpoint, what advice would you give yourself?
I think I would not have sold properties as much as I did. I've heard other folks say that, gosh, I never regret buying something long-term, but I've regretted selling a lot long-term. So I think that the properties I sold, oftentimes I would use that money to turn into a different property. So I can't say I shouldn't have sold it, but I'd get greedy. I'd say, gosh, this property's gone up in value, a significant amount. Let's pull it out, pull the money out. It's payday. And I think I should have been a little bit more long-term thinking in just letting those things ride out and not pulling out as early.
So you said you used to live in Arizona. What about with that in mind, what about the properties that you bought there? Then you moved back to Denver. How does that play out with the long distance rental that you have?
It worked fine for me. I'm kind of knowledgeable on the property management side of things. So I just did long distance landlording. I didn't hire anybody for third party management, got some good tenants in. So it worked out fine from that standpoint, but I knew I didn't want that to necessarily be a long-term play. So I kept my tenants in there, and I think I waited till they moved a couple years down the road. Property had gone up in value, so I sold that. I've had some stuff in Texas as well. I don't have it any longer. I kind of want to be where I can have a higher degree of control on my properties. So I'm not a big out-of-state guy. I know there's other markets that people are always chasing, but I think there, for anybody, there are enough deals in your own backyard that can keep the average investor going.
Let me dive in this topic some more, because I'm interested for myself. I've talked about this briefly in the past on some podcast. I think it's like in 2011, I bought a condo in Reno where I was living at the time. And I mean, dumb luck, this is my first real estate purchase of any type. I bought the cheapest unit in the whole history of the down crash. I just timed it perfectly. Just dumb luck. I bought for like $67,000. I'm renting out now. It's worth $200,000 plus now. And I'm debating. This is one of my goals for this year to figure out is, do I just save it there and hold it for a long term? Or do I move the money to Denver? Because I'm like you, I'm a little bit of a control freak. You get any advice or thoughts on that, since you've sounded like you've been in those shoes before?
Yeah. So do you have any plans to move back to Reno?
No, never.
Okay. So let me ask you this. If you had 200, you said it's worth 200,000?
It's probably worth about, the rough numbers, it's worth about 220, and I've got 30,000 left on a 15-year schedule with about 7 years left. So about 30K of loans left.
Okay. So you've got roughly 200 equity.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the question I always ask is just to kind of flip it around from the other side is, if you had $200,000 cash right now in the bank, would you go buy that property in Reno?
No.
Then sell it.
Okay.
Right? Because I mean, that's what you're doing. I mean, you could cash out if you wanted to. And you've got two choices. You could have $200K in the bank right now to do something with, or you could have that property in Reno. You've chosen to have the property in Reno. But if you wouldn't do the deal today at those numbers, those same numbers, then I would cash out and find something else to do with the money.
Interesting. That's an interesting point of view. So do you kind of do that same, I'll say, analysis with properties local too? I mean, if you look at properties now, like, hey, I've got this property paid off, because let me just play devil's advocate here. you've got some of your properties paid off. Do you go down that same thought question of, hey, am I happy with paying $300,000 for this property now that's paid free and clear and rental? Do I sell it? Or is that, you still do that scenario too?
I still do that scenario. And you do that scenario, I think, when the property has gone up in value. And it's even more important to do that scenario when the property's gone down in value. You know, we haven't talked about that a whole lot, but you know, given enough time, that comes into play. And I've been on in some deals where we've lost a lot of money. And then the question of, do we sell it at a loss or do we wait for it to come back is a real hard conversation to have. But that's where that concept, that accounting concept or that finance concept of a sunk cost comes in, right? I mean, the money's there. The money's not there. It's gone. But what would you do today? Would you buy the property again today at the price it's worth today? And if you wouldn't, then why are you holding on to it? You know, then get out and find something else to do with it. If you don't want that property today at that price and you wouldn't pay for that price for it, then get out, because that's in essence what you're doing. You are buying it today. You are holding it today. You're holding that property in Reno for, it's costing you $200,000 that you could be doing with that something else with that money. I mean, so the opportunity cost of that money is a lot of different things you could do.
Yeah. Thank you. That makes a lot of sense. Buy
me dinner for that one if you sell it, Chris.
Will do. I'll take you out to Elway's and buy a nice steak dinner, all right? So as we wrap up here, we've answered a lot of these questions I had towards the end here. Actually, you've already mentioned this once, but just reiterate or any final thoughts or advice for newer investors or investors starting out right now.
Yeah, I would say, take massive action. You know, don't overanalyze. Just get out there and do the deal, especially for those long-term. If this is going to be a long-term buy and hold, then get out there, buy the best property you can afford. Don't go for the junk because it'll drive you crazy. So buy the best property you can afford and just act. And then also as a kind of a corollary to that, don't over leverage the thing, because that can kill you as well. Those are the biggest mistakes you can make. So don't over leverage it. Get the best one you can and just go.
Wonderful. I mean, that's it. You got any just final thoughts or things you jotted down that you want to speak before we wrap things up, Mark?
No, I would just say that, if like I said earlier, what I love about real estate is it works for anybody. You don't have to be the hardest working person. You don't have to be the smartest person. But if you buy and hold the way our economy works, that property will appreciate in value. It's going to go up on the rental rate. It's going to produce a lot of long-term gains for you. So it's the easy way to achieve financial success.
Wonderful. All right. So as we wrap up here, I want to just mention a few resources that people should check out. So Mark has a website called rentgrace.com, RENTGRACE.com. Two things I'll point out on there. I highly recommend you guys go out there and get on his email newsletter. But Mark does some great content. I forget the exact amount, but I watch a couple videos every month from him that he publishes. Concise, great topics. Get on his newsletter, follow it, a worthwhile resource. And I've also talked to a lot of people out there who are buying properties. They want to self-manage, but they need a lease agreement. And I believe you've got a lease agreement for free on your website, right, Mark?
We've got a sample lease agreement for free on our website. Yeah, we offer that service. We sell our full-blown lease agreement as well. But yes, we sure do.
Okay, so if you guys are out there, I know a lot of people are looking to self-manage, they start their portfolio, definitely check out his website for that resource. Might save you some headache and money versus trying to do it on your own or buy some template off the internet or go into an attorney to draft one up. So check out his resource or call Mark's office. Mark, what's the best way for people to contact you or your team?
Yeah, through our website is the best. And you gave that website address out there. People can reach us through there. We've got a lot of free resources. Our office phone number is 303-255-1990, 303-255-1990. And we're happy to help folks out, whether they need a property management company or they're self-managing. We want to make it easier for them. So they don't even need to hire us, but we've got a lot of free resources. And if they do need that property management contact, we'd love to be that resource.
And a couple months ago, Mark recorded a course on the Denver Investment Real Estate website. It's titled Denver Property Management 101 Course. I think the exact details were like 7 pitfalls or 8 pitfalls that are common, that are specific to the Colorado market. He talks about pets. He talks about the impact of the marijuana on rentals. So if you're getting into landlording, definitely check out the course because it is specific to our market and has lots of great tidbits. I actually saw Mark present this at a classroom one time, and I was actually walking out the door to go do something, and he hit a topic. I actually turned around and sat back down. It was that interesting, so it's worth checking out. So go to denverinvestmentrealestate.com, click on courses, and you'll see Denver Property Management 101. So Mark, thank you so much for taking almost 2 hours out of your day now. I appreciate it. I'm sure other people out there too have gained the wealth of information from your advice. So thank you.
Thank you, Chris. It's been fun.